the limelight.
The FAUS, Florida Coalition for Palestine, a coalition of social justice organizations, has called for a campaign to boycott duty-free Americas because of the role its owners play in funding the settler movement's expulsion of Palestinians from their homes and land. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Donna Neville Ryder. This article is titled, Boycott Duty-Free Americas. Don't buy airport goods that fund Zionist settlers. Palestinian lawyer Mohammad Khatib once dreamed of bringing his own children back to ride the swing in the Roman olive tree where he used to play as a child, but that vision was shattered by the ongoing illegal expansion of the Israeli settlements. I always dreamed that this olive tree and this place that I used to play when I was a child, that my children will play there, Khatib said, adding, unfortunately, this has been demolished. This has been uprooted. And its place, they have built a huge settlement. Khatib's story is all too familiar. The settlement enterprise backed by the Zionist regime is responsible for stealing Palestinian land and has destroyed approximately 48,000 Palestinian homes in the occupied territories since 1967. This ongoing process of settler colonialism began prior to the Zionist regime's creation in 1948, when 750,000 Palestinians were expelled from their land and homes by the Zionist movement. Known as Nakba, or catastrophe in Arabic, it continues to this day. Khatib, a human rights activist, was invited to share his experiences at the recent online launch of the campaign to boycott Duty Free Americas, that is DFA, a chain of stores owned by a family that has donated millions of dollars to fund right-wing Israeli settler organizations. Owned by Falik family from South Florida, Duty Free Americas operates over 180 duty-free stores that sell items like chocolates at airports and border crossings across the U.S. and Latin America. As reported by the Associated Press, the Falik family has donated at least $5.6 million to settler groups in the West Bank and East Al-Quds over the past decade. And according to Haaretz, the Falik family also operates the Panama-based Seagull Foundation for the Israeli regime, which ran afoul of even Israeli law because it did little more than transfer millions of shekels to right-wing organizations in occupied territories. As documented by the Palestinian-led campaign Defund Racism, so-called charitable funds raised in the U.S. from donors such as the Falik family are used to carry out the mission of the Israeli settler organizations. The South Florida Coalition for Palestine, a coalition of social justice organizations, has called for a campaign to boycott duty-free Americas because of the role its owners play in funding the settler movement's expulsion of Palestinians from their own homes and land. The coalition felt a particular responsibility to initiate this campaign given that the headquarters of duty-free Americas and its owners are based in South Florida. At the launch of the boycott campaign against Duty Free America, South Florida Coalition for Palestine member Ken Barnes, who is also a South Florida representative with Jewish Voice for Peace said, "We are boycotting due to Free Americans until they stop funding Israeli apartheid." Anas Amira, another coalition member representing Al-Auda, the Palestinian Right to Return Coalition, echoed this sentiment, saying, "A corporation or business that funds the ethnic cleansing of an indigenous nation must be held accountable." Meanwhile, in a video produced by Defund Racism campaign and shown at the launch, Muhammad Al-Kurd, a writer, poet and activist from Sheikh Jarrah, explained the role of settler organizations. "You know, we often say and speak about this settler colonialism," he said, "but when you see how it manifests and how this subtle colonialism crystallizes in real life, it is through the settler organizations who actively work to displace Palestinians or isolate Palestinians from one another in the Nakba, in occupied 48 territories, or in the West Bank." Khatib emphasized that settlements are violent places, explaining that many Israeli settlers are ready to kill, beat, and threaten Palestinian farmers to prevent them from reaching their homes and land. Khatib said, "What these settlers are doing, no one could imagine and accept it. And all of this is coming from American support. Let's end U.S. complicity in Zionist settler colonialism," added Bana Abu Zulof of the Good Shepherd Collective and Defund Racism campaign, discussing the importance of using multidimensional strategies and identifying clear targets in boycott campaigns such as this one. "The organizers of the campaign to boycott duty-free Americas intend to engage in protests and community education to continue to strategize and coordinate with partners in the U.S. and in Palestine. A simple ask coming from the coalition is for the people to send photos with signs saying, 'Boycott duty-free Americas or DFA funds ethnic cleansing at the airport,' in front of DFA shops or at home." The groups representing the coalition say they are committed to long-term organizing and community building around this issue. Samir Kalki from the South Florida Muslim Federation spoke at the launch of the campaign about the power of organizing collectively and collaboratively, saying, "While we are constantly in a state of heartache due to the ongoing apartheid and occupation of the Israeli regime, we are also strengthened by the very strong and principled resistance taking place in Palestine and across the globe. Individuals, groups, and communities must continue to come together and collaborate in partnership, for the best results will come from working as a powerful collective." The organizers of the boycott campaign understand that there will surely be opposition coming from supporters of the Zionist settlements and from those who deny Palestinians their humanity. But Lara Ghanem of the Florida branch of the Council on American Islamic Relations urged activists to remain steadfast in their clarity about the reasons for the campaign. She said, "This is about human rights. This is about the silence of the world leaders as 73 years of violence continue against the Palestinian people. And this is why it is vital for us, everyone here today, everyone watching, to join the campaign to boycott duty-free Americas."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Women's growth and progress thanks to the Islamic Republic. The 3rd of February, 2021. Islam considers men and women to be equal in terms of human values. For Muslim men and women, for believing men and women, for devout men and women, for true men and women, for men and women who are patient and constant. The Holy Quran 33:35. Muslim men and women are not different from one another in terms of divine and human values. They have common duties such as enjoining the good, rendering services and doing jihad in the way of God. Each of these duties is somehow shared by both men and women, and they are not particular to men or to women. And each has particular duties. Women have particular duties and men have particular duties, and Allah, the Exalted, has created their bodies and their souls in line with these duties. So, this is the viewpoint of Islam in the Islamic Republic towards women, and we are proud of it. We are completely against the Western logic, methodology, and lifestyle about women, and we believe that they are oppressing women. Western propaganda massively promotes the idea that the Islamic perspective hinders women's growth and development. This is a clear lie and a completely biased statement. In our country, at no point in history, neither in the past nor in the era of westernization, did we ever have so many educated women active in social, cultural, and scientific areas. We did not have all these women capable of influencing the social destiny. We did not have all these women with the power to understand and analyze political affairs. And we did not have so many female writers, female translators, and female artists in the true sense of the word. All these have been achieved thanks to the Islamic Republic and the viewpoint of Islam on women, which is based on respect. Now, I deem it necessary to express my respect for martyrs, mothers, and wives in two different generations. One during the Sacred Defense era, and the other during the defense of the holy shrines. In those eras, martyrs, wives, and mothers played a really determining and unique role, and one should bow down before them in respect. Unfortunately, there are few artistic productions about these dear and great personalities. This is an extraordinarily outstanding capacity for which there is more room for work.
You've done. B English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Emerging data suggests that Delta could spread more readily than other coronavirus variants among people vaccinated against COVID-19. But key questions remain. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Nidhi Soberman Ryder. This article is published under the heading, How Do Vaccinated People Spread Delta? What Science Says. Stay tuned for more. When early field data showed that vaccinating people caught transmission of the SARS-CoV-2 virus, researchers were cautiously optimistic. But they warned that many of those studies, although promising, took place before the fast-spreading Delta variant proliferated worldwide. Now reports from various counties seem to confirm what scientists feared after the variant tore through India with alarming speed in April and May. Delta is more likely than other variants to spread through vaccinated people. Data from COVID-19 tests in the United States, the United Kingdom, and Singapore are showing that vaccinated people who become infected with Delta SARS-CoV-2 can carry as much virus in their nose as do unvaccinated people. This means that despite the protection offered by vaccines, a proportion of vaccinated people can pass on Delta, possibly aiding its rise. People who have a Delta virus and happen to have breakthrough infections can carry these really high levels of virus and can unwittingly spread the virus to others, says David O'Connor, a virologist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. The findings underscore the importance of protective measures such as wearing masks indoors to reduce transmission. Researchers stress that COVID-19 vaccines are protective against serious illnesses and death. But the data on Delta transmission show that people who are vaccinated still need to take precautions, O'Connor says. O'Connor and colleagues at Madison and Dane County Health Department looked at infections in Wisconsin in June and July. The team used PCR tests, which are widely used to confirm COVID-19 infections, to estimate the concentration of virus in nasal fluid samples. The tests detect the virus genetic material by amplifying DNA until it is detectable as a fluorescent signal. The number of amplification cycles needed to get a signal, a measure called the cycle threshold value or CT, serves as a proxy for viral concentration in the sample. The lower a sample CT, the more viral genetic material present. In a preprint study published on MedRxiv on August 11th, the researchers compared CT values for 719 people between June 29th and July 31st, during which 90% of the 122 coronavirus samples they sequenced were the Delta variant. Of the 311 vaccinated people who tested positive for SARS-CoV-2 in that group, most had CT values of less than 25, a level at which researchers expect the presence of infectious SARS-CoV-2. To confirm this, the team cultured 55 samples that had CT values less than 25 from vaccinated and unvaccinated people and detected infectious virus in nearly everyone. Most unvaccinated people also had CT values below this level. The bottom line is this can happen. It can be true that vaccinated people can spread the virus, but we do not yet know what their relative role in overall community spread is, says co-author Thomas Friedrich, a virologist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Data from Provincetown, Massachusetts suggests similar findings. An August report from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, showed that following large gatherings in Beach Town, nearly three-quarters of 469 new COVID-19 cases that occurred in the state were in vaccinated people. Both vaccinated and unvaccinated people had comparably low CT values, indicating high viral loads, and of the 133 samples sequenced, 90% were identified as Delta. The findings prompted the CDC to update its guidance on July 27th and once again recommend that people in areas of high transmission wear masks indoors. The Provincetown results were linked to big gatherings, but Wisconsin didn't have similar activities, suggesting that the small household gatherings could also help Delta to spread, Friedrich says. In Houston, Texas, where a Houston Methodist hospital team has been sequencing and logging SARS-CoV-2 variants for almost every COVID-19 case in the hospital system, about 17% of Delta cases are in vaccinated people since March 2021, nearly three times the rate of breakthrough infections compared with all other variants combined. Patients with Delta SARS-CoV-2 also staged in hospital slightly longer than did people infected with other variants. James Musser, a molecular pathologist and director of the Hospital Center for Molecular and Transnational Human Infectious Diseases Research, said there is potentially a slightly different biology to the infection. His team found that CT levels were similar in vaccinated and unvaccinated people. However, vaccinated people with Delta might remain infectious for a shorter period, according to researchers in Singapore, who tracked the viral loads for each day of COVID-19 infection among people who had and hadn't been vaccinated. Delta viral loads were similar for both groups for the first week of infection, but dropped quickly after day 7 in vaccinated people. Given the high virus levels seen in the first week of illness with Delta, measures such as masks and hand hygiene, which can reduce transmission, are important for everyone, regardless of vaccination status, says co-author Barnaby Young, an infectious disease clinician at the National Center for Infectious Diseases in Singapore. One massive analysis of Delta transmission comes from the UK, led by a team at Imperial College London, which tests more than 100,000 UK volunteers every few weeks. The team ran CT analysis of samples received in May, June, and July, when Delta was rapidly replacing other variants to become the dominant driver of COVID-19 in the country. The results suggested that among people testing positive, those who had been vaccinated had a lower viral load on average than did unvaccinated people. Paul Elliott, an epidemiologist at Imperial, says that these results differ from other CT studies because this study sampled the population at random and included people who tested positive without showing symptoms. These findings, along with an increase in cases in younger people who have not yet received both jabs, underscore the effectiveness of double vaccination against Delta, Elliott says. We think it's really, really important to get as many people double vaccinated, and particularly those younger groups, as soon as possible.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Thanks so much for being with us. More injustice against Yemen as the United Nations turns its back on even investigating possible war crimes. This as the UN Human Rights Council has voted to shut down its war crimes investigations in Yemen. How can this be the case when at least 100,000 civilians have been killed in the Saudi-led onslaught on the Yemeni people?
The United Nations Human Rights Council has voted against renewing the body's mandate for investigating possible war crimes committed by the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen. Members narrowly voted to reject a motion brought by countries including the Netherlands and Canada to give UN investigators another 2 years to monitor atrocities in Yemen. It marked the first time in the Council's 15-year history that a resolution was defeated. Ahead of the vote, UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet said there was no peace in sight in Yemen and that urgent funding was needed to avert large-scale famine there. Meanwhile, the Dutch ambassador called the vote a major setback, adding that the council failed the Yemeni people and cut their lifeline to the international community. Rights activists had previously warned that Riyadh was heavily lobbying against the resolution in a blatant attempt to ensure blanket impunity for crimes and other violations of international law in Yemen. They also accused the UNHRC of bowing to Saudi pressure and putting politics before principle. Experts believe the council has lost its credibility by shutting down the investigation.
UN Human Rights Council has lost any credibility it once had, and that was marginal anyway. But by shutting down an investigation into atrocities committed in Yemen this is something that is clear to anybody, that horrendous things are happening in Yemen. And the fact that some other countries have strong-armed those council members to vote against this is just politics, but it's corruption, and it's tragic for the people of Yemen.
This is not the first time Saudi Arabia has used what many call arm twisting to stop the UN from scrutinizing the Yemen war. Back in 2016, Saudi Arabia was removed from the UN's list of children's rights violators after Riyadh threatened to cut off crucial funding to the world body. The Saudi-led war on Yemen has claimed tens of thousands of lives and displaced millions, resulting in what the UN describes as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The coalition, which is logistically and militarily supported by the West, especially the US and the UK, has repeatedly bombed schools, hospitals, and other civilian facilities during its seven-year onslaught. The United Nations has in the past been criticized for its inaction against Riyadh, but the latest move by the Human Rights Council seems like giving a green light to Saudi Arabia and some of its regional allies to continue their atrocities against impoverished Yemen with impunity.
I'd like to welcome my guests to this program, Director of Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Mr. Zafar Bangash, out of Toronto. And political commentator and peace activist, Brian Terrell, out of Molloy, Iowa.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you both for being with us. Well, let's start this off with Zafar out of Toronto. Isn't even saying that investigations will be stopped into possible war crimes ironic to begin with? I mean, when there have been so many civilians killed, shouldn't it be obvious that war crimes have been committed?
Oh, absolutely. I think the manner in which they UN Human Rights Council has acted is absolutely scandalous when it is well known and well established that at least 100,000 people have been killed in Yemen since March of 2015 when the Saudis launched their murderous assault on that poorest of countries in the Middle East. And more than a million children are suffering from cholera. The UN agencies themselves have said that the vast majority of the Yemeni people are on the verge of starvation. And for the UN Human Rights Council now to vote to end the investigation into Saudi crimes is absolutely scandalous. I think we also need to keep in mind that the Saudi regime has an atrocious record even at home. There are tens of thousands of political prisoners in Saudi Arabia. Dissidents are murdered, they are shot to death, they are executed. All kinds of other oppressions are taking place inside Saudi Arabia. But in terms of its crimes in Yemen, I think it is well established. I mean, the UN itself has said that there have been hundreds of thousands of casualties over there. The UN itself has said that there is mass starvation, that children are suffering terribly. So to stop this investigation into Saudi war crimes makes a mockery of the UN Human Rights Council and the manner in which it conducts its business.
Well, Brian, Yemen has actually just commemorated an attack on a funeral procession 5 years ago where over 100 people were killed. How can the Saudis get away with that and such an act not be considered a war crime?
Well, it is certainly that was one crime of many, and I think what it comes down to is the U.S. and other Western countries, the arms manufacturers, are making a lot of money off of this, and a investigation into the war crimes is inconvenient, you know, to those. A year ago, earlier this year, when it appeared that the United States, President Biden, was talking about cutting off the weapons flow to the Saudis, and the head of CEO of Raytheon Corporation told his stockholders, peace is not going to break out anytime soon in the Middle East, and we will continue to see this an area of continued growth. I think it's also the politics involved it's a year ago, almost exactly a year ago, Saudi Arabia tried to get a seat on this very council, the Human Rights Council of the United Nations, and was defeated. But the bid to stop this investigation was led by the ambassador from Bahrain, and I've been to Bahrain, and to say that the Bahrain, the Hamad monarchy in Bahrain is a government for the people of Bahrain with their welfare and interests at heart is really absurd. It really is. It's a Saudi proxy, and this is how the Saudis have been able to do this. They really do have a seat on this council, only it's named after the Kingdom of Bahrain.
Well, Zafar, why haven't we seen more intervention to stop the carnage by this Saudi regime in Yemen from the so-called international community again?
Well, basically, as Brian pointed out, it has a lot to do with the sale of weapons, and Saudi Arabia is the largest importer of weapons in the Middle East by far, and in fact, even in terms of weapons imports worldwide, Saudi Arabia is right there at the top. And we need to keep in mind that in weapons sales, the returns on profits is enormous. And so the weapons manufacturers want to encourage more wars so that their weapons are sold, so that they can their weapons are used, so that they can sell more weapons. And so wars for them is a profitable business. And that's why we see that around the world, countries like the United States, Britain, France, other weapons manufacturers are very happy to see these wars continue, even when the Saudis are perpetrating horrific crimes. And we also need to keep in mind that these Western countries are also guilty of war crimes, just as the Zionist regime in occupied Palestine is. And you know, let's remember back in earlier this year, the International Criminal Court actually said that they have the right to investigate Israeli crimes against the Palestinians. And when the ICC chief prosecutor was changed in June because her term ended in June and a new chief prosecutor came on board, this matter against the Zionist regime has gone silent. So we see that not only the Saudi crimes in Yemen, but the Western regimes themselves are guilty of horrendous crimes against humanity, and therefore they're not going to push for any investigation of Saudi crimes. The only time they push for any investigations is if there is a government or a ruler that does not toe the American line, then they go after such a government or particular ruler, and they try to haul that particular ruler before the International Criminal Court. So in this case, we see that there are definitely double standards being applied. I don't think that there is any doubt in the minds of anybody that Saudi Arabia is a gross violator of human rights. It has committed war crimes in Yemen. But unfortunately, there are countries around the world, Western countries, that are quite happy supplying it weapons, and they want to shield the Saudi regime from any criticism or any investigation that would haul these criminals or they bring these criminals to justice.
Ryan, what do you make of what Zafar just said? So if the case is so that these many of these Western governments are also involved in war crimes, whether in Yemen or other places, and continue to basically shield Saudi Arabia. So, I mean, isn't the whole concept then of a United Nations Human Rights Council, and even perhaps the United Nations itself, when these countries have so much power on a committee like that, or in the United Nations itself, like the Security Council, I mean, at the end of the day, what does it really do if these countries are also complicit?
Yeah, well, this instance calls to mind just a couple of years ago, the International Criminal Court was investigating the United States for war crimes in Afghanistan, and the United States responded by putting sanctions against the investigators. So yeah, the Dutch ambassador has said, rightly, that the council has failed the people of Yemen, and in the most immediate sense, that's true, where you have 18 million people facing starvation in the very near term. But in the broader sense, this has failed the people of the world, and it's as has been mentioned, this UN Human Rights Council has had very little credibility. But what credibility it has really it is lost, and it's tragic for people who are looking for the people of the world, who are looking for ways that to solve problems through diplomacy, but of course diplomacy doesn't bring in a lot of cash for the arms manufacturers, who really are more than our governments, more than our kingdoms and legislators, and more than the United Nations setting policy and setting the course of the world.
Zafar, do you think that if Washington ordered Riyadh to stop the war today, that it could end today?
Oh, absolutely. The United States exercises enormous influence for a number of reasons. As you know, you mentioned in your earlier question that it has a very, very large say in the UN Security Council. The UN Security Council basically is a body in which five permanent members dictate to the rest of the world. And so they can get away literally with crimes and murder, and nobody can touch them. If, for instance, the United States wanted to stop this horrendous war in Yemen and stop these war crimes from being committed in Yemen, it could do so, because the United States is supporting the Saudi regime. It is providing intelligence information. It is, in fact, identifying targets for the Saudis to hit, although the Saudis are so incompetent that they often fail to hit military targets, and they target civilian populations, schools, hospitals, grain depots, and so on. The list is endless. I mean, the number of crimes that the Saudis have perpetrated in Yemen is absolutely horrendous. It is well known. It is well documented. The only people that are basically shying away from it is the UN Human Rights Council, under pressure from the Western regimes, because the Western regimes themselves are complicit in these crimes. We need to remember that since 9/11, the United States and its allies have murdered an estimated 32 million people worldwide. You can take Afghanistan and Iraq and Yemen and Libya and Syria, Lebanon, Somalia, Mali at the present time. In all of these countries, horrendous crimes are being perpetrated by the Western regimes. And this is well documented. This is not something, it was an Australian professor who did the analysis, and he came up with the figure of 32 million largely civilians killed over the last 20 years. So what we are witnessing is that worldwide, all of these regimes are perpetrating these horrific crimes. And so in that sense, they are complicit in the Saudi crimes in Yemen as well. And that is why the U.S., although it has the power and the authority to stop these crimes, it doesn't want to do so, as we mentioned earlier, because if the war in Yemen ended, then who's going to be selling weapons to Saudi Arabia? The Saudis would not need any more weapons. And so it has to do with selling weapons. It has to do with Saudi Arabia serving as a cash cow. And it has to do with keeping that entire Middle East region unstable so that the Zionist regime can continue to maintain its hegemony and the people of the region, that is the Middle East, continue to pay a very, very heavy price.
You just made interesting points, Zafar and Brian. So if it is the case, as Zafar has said, that obviously Washington could make this war in. So is it in the U.S.'s strategic interest to keep this war going? I mean, Zafar just talked about, and you also mentioned about, as far as selling arms. But at the end of the day, does it help the United States strategically to continue this war against Yemen?
No, it doesn't help the people of the United States. It doesn't help what really our U.S. interests. What it helps is the arms industry, and it's the people of the United States in various ways, not as dramatically immediately as the people of Yemen. But we're in a country with a decaying infrastructure. We have we are the industrialized country with the most inept healthcare, education system. Things are falling apart here because of the same thing. This is not helping the United States. It's helping the corporations that own the politicians. So no, it's not in anyone's interest. I think the United States really ought to, at this point, with the challenge of climate change, ought to be thinking about other options rather than using our own shale oil that was considered too dirty to process only a few years ago, or trying to control the oil flow out of the Middle East. We need to be finding alternatives, and that would be to the interest of the United States, of its people, but it would be very hard on the arms manufacturers and the U.S. Based petroleum industry.
Well, Zafar, we have seen the Yemenis be resilient in fighting back and trying to resist the Saudi-led onslaught. Do you think that the more the Yemenis feel that injustice is being waged against them by the Saudis and their supporters, the more defiant the Yemenis have become?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, the people of Yemen have demonstrated over the last 6.5 years or so that they will not tolerate foreign aggression. They have shown remarkable resilience despite the fact that they are extremely poor. They have paid a very heavy price, but they are now hitting back. And I think this is something that we need to look at in the broader context, in the sense that when people are under oppression, when people are getting killed, they are being bombed, crimes are being committed against them, they are left with absolutely no choice but to fight back. And I think in case of Yemen, and we saw earlier in Afghanistan as well, where the people fought against the U.S. and its allies for 20 years, ultimately driving the U.S. out of Afghanistan, although it cost the U.S. $2.26 trillion, and all of that money has gone down the drain. But in case of Yemen, the Yemenis are putting up a very stiff resistance, and they're also targeting vital military installations inside Saudi Arabia. And I think that the time is getting closer when the Yemenis would be able to get rid of this Saudi aggression, to defeat the Saudi aggressors completely, and perhaps even as a bonus to get rid of the ruling corrupt Saudi family, because they have been a bane not only for the people of Saudi Arabia, but virtually the entire Muslim world. And so that day, we hope, is sooner rather than later, but definitely We salute the Yemeni people for their courageous resistance in the face of enormous odds.
Well, Brian, in your perspective, I mean, is there any solution to this Saudi onslaught other than the resistance by the Yemenis? Because obviously the so-called international community has failed the Yemeni people. Do they have any alternative but resistance?
Well, I'd like to, I think what's needed, and I don't want to be pessimistic about this. I'm actually hopeful against hope that the people of these Western countries, the people of the United States and other countries, have to confront their own governments, and we have to demand change. Yemeni people rising up. We applaud their courage. But it's going to need, as an American citizen, I have to say, we really need to make changes here. And this is what our responsibility is. And also, I'd like to take issue with the idea that $2.2 trillion went down the drain in the United States from the Afghan war. That $2.2 trillion went to the pockets of certain people and certain institutions here in the United States and other places around the world. And that's what it was intended to do. And that's what the U.S. involvement and the Saudi war in Yemen is intended to do too. It's a cycle. It's not intended to end. And if it's going to end, it has to end because people rise up and demand and put a stick in the spoke of that wheel, because it's just going around and around and around. And the fate of the world is really in balance.
Basically what you're saying is that the people have lost on both sides of the spectrum, that the Afghans have lost their lives, the Yemenis are losing their lives, and the Americans, their lifestyle is getting worse and worse. On that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with us on the Spotlight, the Director of Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Zafar Bangash out of Toronto, and political commentator and peace activist Brian Terrell out of Molloy, Iowa. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran.